Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that was Harry Connick Jr., born on this day in 1967, After You've Gone. We are now switching gears from police and issues of police power to what happens, what's going on in the Middle East, and the President Barack Obama's speech to the nation last night. We will be joined by three guests. Two of them are with us now. We are here with Dr. Stephen David, who is professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and Phyllis Bennis, who is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of many books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, or Primer, and many other books that open the doors about our thinking about Iraq and the Palestine and the Middle East. Good to have you both with us.
Great to be with you.
Nice to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But please join us, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on last night. And I was been reading the press from Republicans to Democrats to progressives and others are saying about this, and there's some real conflict over what all this means. Let me start with you, Stephen David, and your analysis just off the top first of what you thought of President Barack Obama's speech last night.
Well, I thought it was a good speech. I mean, he made a compelling case that ISIS presents a threat not only to the region but to the United States, although I think the threat to America is somewhat exaggerated. He took pains to make it clear that we're not going to have large numbers of boots on the ground. We will have advisors and, of course, airstrikes. And I think he made the correct decision not to give ISIS a sanctuary in Syria. I mean, the border between Syria and Iraq has long since not existed. And to allow ISIS to retreat there and be safe is silly. And my sense is public opinion is swinging his way. One part of the speech I didn't like was the end part of the speech when he talked about jobs and the American economy. We're doing well. I thought that was a sort of a jarring note that was sort of out of place in what was a call to arms.
Phyllis Bennis?
Well, I have a completely different view, I suppose. I think that this was a speech that was, I do agree on the one point that this was very much driven by public opinion. This was a speech that was made necessary in the Obama White House's view because public opinion had started demanding a response after the horrific killing of the two U.S. journalists. And in my view, revenge never makes for good foreign policy. This was an answer to a public demand that was, of course, picked up by various opponents of Obama, the Republicans, McCain, all the usuals. But this was in a situation where the position that Obama has been saying over and over again, there is no military solution, which I happen to agree with, was completely abandoned in his 4 points. Almost all of it was focused on the military solution while he's saying there is no military solution. The non-military aspects, the only serious one was the fourth one, which about humanitarian support, which is, of course, crucial. But the rest was overwhelmingly about military goals. And I think, you know, the notion that ISIS is a threat to the United States, you know, his own advisors are saying that that's not true. The statement from the former chief of the National Counterterrorism Center said there is no credible information that ISIS is planning to attack. There's no indication that there is a cell of foreign fighters operating in the U.S. This notion that somehow it's fine to go to war because an organization that makes wild threats and commits terrible crimes against people where it is somehow gives us the right to go to war is, first of all, illegal. In Iraq, it's obviously a different situation where the government has requested it, but that government has been acting essentially as the biggest Shia militia in the country. But it also goes to the question of why do we think this is going to work in a situation where the reason for ISIS power has everything to do with its reliance on support from the local community, from the Sunni tribal leaders who have placed many of their militias at the service of ISIS, to the Sunni former generals from the Saddam Hussein era who are providing the military know-how to ISIS. That's a big part of the reason for their military successes. And ordinary Sunnis who are desperate, who are facing years now of sectarian violence from the hands of the U.S.-backed government, first of Nouri al-Maliki, and now there's a new prime minister who's saying all the right things. That's all good, but who has not yet chosen a minister to control either the military or the security agencies who are responsible for these attacks on Sunni communities. So there's no trust in the government, and the idea that U.S. bombing is going to be seen in Iraq the same as it's seen here. You know, we see it as, yay, we got the bad guys. For Iraqi Sunnis, what they see is the U.S. military coming in and acting as the air force for the Shia and the Kurds against the Sunni. So we're making things worse, not better.
So, I think, is it fair to say in some ways, and there are very specific things I want to ask, and I'll do that at the break as soon as Tavit Abdullah joins us as well, so we can have this broad kind of look at it. But is it fair to say, for Stephen and Phyllis, that I think that the West in general does not know how to respond to this? I mean, there are clearly the roots of ISIS, as Tabit has said in this last program, are from Iraq and out of the invasion of Iraq and this creation of this whole war that happened in America, that America foisted onto Iraq. But we do not really know how to respond to it. I think that that's part of the problem of why President Barack Obama just never was clear about what he wanted to do. Now as clear as I think Phyllis said because of the opinion polls, Stephen, but I think that people are really not sure how to respond at all.
Well, to say we're not sure how to respond doesn't mean, you know, our response is wrong. Look, I mean, you can say that you need a political solution to ISIS, and of course you do, but ISIS does present a military threat, and part of the answer, at least, is defeating it militarily. Look, these are really bad guys, and they're occupying large swaths of land. They have over 4 million people under their control. They're destabilizing an already unstable Middle East. They could bring about the undermining of one of our allies in Iraq. So we worry about European and Americans who are fighting in ISIS who will come back to their home countries, including the United States, and cause problems here. I don't see it as a threat on the level of al-Qaeda, but it is a threat. These are horrific people, and if we can contain and destroy them, so much the better.
So we do have to take a break, I'm just told. We'll come right back with Phyllis Bennis. We're going to break here, as we do with our day in history, with Stagger Lee, recorded on this day, September 11th in 1958, by Lloyd Price. We'll be right back with Philip Bennis, Dr. Stephen David, and Tabit Abdullah will join the conversation at that time. Join us here at 410-319-8888.
Tumbling down. I was standing. Because of you, I cried a tear. Because we're through, I cried a tear. What else could I do but cry inside for love of you?
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. That's Laverne Baker. I Cried a Tear, recorded on this day in 1958. We're here with Dr. Stephen David, professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, Dr. Tabit Abdullah, associate professor of Middle East History and associate dean for external relations at York University in Toronto. And we go back to our conversation about President Barack Obama's statement last night and where that leaves us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But let me wrestle with a question that has been raised in different ways by Stephen David, and you countered it very differently, Phyllis, and we'll go to you first and bring Tabit in to respond, and then Stephen. This whole question of threat, the Islamic State being a threat to the West, the Islamic State being a threat to the United States. We know clearly it's a threat to the future of Iraq. It's clearly a threat to Syria and maybe now Lebanon as well. It controls an area as large as the state of Maryland. By one commentator, up to 8 million people under its rule and practicing genocide against minorities and others. So let's talk about this issue of threat and what threat means.
You know, there's no question, I think, that ISIS represents a serious threat for the people who live under its control, the people who live in the surrounding areas. The question I think we have to raise is, one, is it a threat to the United States? And I think that the U.S. intelligence agencies are pretty united that it is not. But beyond that, it goes to the question of, what do you do about it? You know, this notion that the only choice is we either do nothing or we go to war is simply a false dichotomy. This is the same thing we were told by George Bush back in 2001, 13 years ago today, where the question was, do we go to war or do we let them get away with it? And, of course, posed with that option, overwhelmingly people chose war. 88% of people said it was right to attack Afghanistan, despite the fact that the 9/11 hijackers were not living in Afghanistan. They weren't from Afghanistan. They weren't studying in Afghanistan. They were studying in Germany. They weren't going to flight school in Afghanistan. They were going to flight school in Florida. So, you know, all
but
of these
but they trained
about
in Afghanistan.
What do we do?
On bases
goes
designed,
to the issue of
well, what, military, one at a time.
Does military force work? And I think the point is that it doesn't. It increases support from people who are looking to Islamist organizations, and that's happened with Al-Qaeda, and I think we'll see it happen again. It increases the sense of fear from Sunnis in Iraq, who see the U.S. going in on the side of the Kurds and the Shia-dominated government against a Sunni force, even if they don't like that Sunni force. So it undermines the goal that I think everybody shares of how do we get people to stop supporting these people? How do we get the support for ISIS to be diminished rather than raised? What we're doing right now is raising the support, not diminishing it.
You were saying, why, Stephen, then we'll go right to Tabit.
Again, with Afghanistan, it wasn't simply a random event. I mean, Al-Qaeda had bases in Afghanistan where people were trained to do what they did on 9/11. So it wasn't just, let's just attack Afghanistan. In fact, I think the American response to Afghanistan was far more justified than the initial war with Iraq. But again, I don't want to divert attention from the ISIS discussion we're having today.
Tabit?
Yes, how do you do? I'm sorry, I'm joining a little bit late into this conversation. I agree with much of what Professor Phyllis Bennis mentioned, but there is another issue here that I think is two other issues actually that I think it's important for people to consider. First of all, there's a horrendous humanitarian issue involved here. I have no liking for the United States to enter. I'm extremely worried about the consequences of yet another wave of U.S. bombardment and military advisors and so forth. But the humanitarian situation is not something that one can sweep under the carpet and say that, if we go in, we're just going to make things worse. I think the Iraqi government, as dysfunctional as it is, as problematic as it is, represents a very large part of the Iraqi public, and they have asked the United States for help. And there simply is no other force that is willing to actually go in and do anything that is powerful enough to assist in alleviating some of the humanitarian catastrophes in the area other than the United States. So I think, you know, that with all the criticisms, with all the suspicion that I would have myself as an Iraqi, I'm forced to say yes, I would support the United States going in because of the horrendous humanitarian situation. There's a second point, however, and that is that The United States went into Iraq in 2003. Of course, it had gone in before that. It had participated in what has developed in Iraq. ISIS very much is a product of the United States destroying the state of Iraq. So the United States bears a very direct responsibility, and it must act on this responsibility. It cannot simply not do anything about it. I know this is not what's being suggested, but what else can be done right now? I mean, I think it's essential that the United States goes in. There's one other thing I just want to point out. Currently, there's a meeting in Jeddah. You know, the Curry has gone in there. The United States is calling in, trying to form some kind of an alliance. Already, it's problematic, and it smells bad to high heaven. The Saudis and the Qataris and the Kuwaitis, and to a lesser extent, the Turks themselves have played a very direct role in actually nurturing the development of this group. The two main parties, the Iraqi government and the Syrian government, as problematic as they are, they're not even invited in that meeting. This is not a very good start to trying to form a coalition.
Absolutely.
So, Phyllis, let me let you come back in here before we go back to the other guests and go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. I mean, and I was thinking about what Talbot was saying. He said this in a recent conversation we had as well. And Talbot, as you have been coming on this program since before the Iraq War happened, both of you opposing that invasion. So, but there's an interesting twist here, and I think difference between you, and I'd like to explore that in some depth.
Well, I think that what we're looking at is this question of a coalition. I must say, stunned to hear President Obama use actually George Bush's language, the coalition of the willing, to describe it. We called it the coalition of the killing. We called it the coalition of the coerced when that happened 11 years ago. This coalition, it's actually two separate coalitions. One is the coalition of what we might say are the white colonial countries, you know, all the European countries plus Australia, the U.S. and Canada, Turkey being the only exception because it's a member of NATO, who are allegedly going to be providing military engagement. So far, it's not clear who beyond the U.S. is going to actually provide what, but that's the theory. The other coalition is based on this meeting that's going on in the region, which is made up of the overwhelmingly repressive Arab regimes dependent on U.S. power, who buy their weapons from the U.S., who are dependent on the U.S. That is, as Talbot was just saying, that's a very dicey basis for a real coalition. What we really should have been looking at, if the speech we should have heard last night, would have been a speech, instead of saying a four-part strategy for military assault, even though we recognize that there is no military solution, we should have heard a four-part strategy for real diplomatic engagement. And that's, I think, what we really did not hear and what we should have heard. This was a piece, I just posted a piece on The Nation about this.
I read
that,
yes.
Could look like. But I think that's really the key thing. We need a coalition that's based on, that has a mandate for diplomacy, diplomatic pressure, economic pressure. And that, what does that mean? That means things
but
like
on
pressure,
who? Pressure on
pressuring,
who?
Pressuring Turkey to stop allowing ISIS and other armed fighters back and forth over their border. Pressure on Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, the other Gulf petrostates to stop funding not only ISIS, but everybody and their brother in Syria who says that they're against the Assad regime. We need serious pressure on those that are enabling ISIS and its neighbors. I mean, if we don't get ISIS, we're going to get the al-Nusra Front, which is the official al-Qaeda franchise in Iraq. So this is a very messy bit of business here. When President Obama talks about, well, part of our strategy will be to bulk up our support and our arming and training of the, quote, moderate Syrian opposition. That he's talking about the Free Syrian Army. Well, we read in the New York Times, although no one else in the U.S. press picked it up, the Free Syrian Army beheaded 6 people 2 weeks ago. We heard nothing about it because they were not Americans. The one American they captured, they shot to death. The non-Americans, they beheaded. So this notion that ISIS is somehow exceptional or unique because of the horror of beheading is simply not the case. The Saudi Arabian government beheaded 19 people in August, convicted mainly of nonviolent drug crime. So this, you know, we have to get past this notion that somehow ISIS is so consummately evil that we can't deal with them by any means other than killing them.
So
it's not going to work.
This is an interesting time. Let me get to Stephen and Talbot to think about what was just said. Stephen, and then we'll go to Talbot. Then I'll go to the phones.
Look, I think most people would have no problem with using diplomacy, using economic pressure, all those things. But right now, ISIS is presenting a direct and immediate military threat to the people under its occupation, including minorities of all kinds, Christians, people who don't adopt the extreme form of Sunni Islam. The notion that somehow these people should wait for a diplomatic engagement or some kind of economic pressure strikes me as preposterous. First of all, ISIS is very wealthy on its own. It's has many millions of dollars. It got through illegal activities. It took over the Iraqi banks. The thought that somehow economic pressure or diplomatic pressure are going to stop these thugs, I can't accept that as a serious argument. Yes, we have to do non-military things. We have to pursue other paths to deal with the fundamental causes. But right now, you've got these horrible murderers. The only thing that's going to stop them is military force. Now, not just American military force. Look, the Iraqi army has over 200,000 men. You've got the Peshmerga. You've got the people who are in the area who are more threatened, far more than the United States. But they do need American assistance. And for the United States to provide air support, some advisors, to give them the strength and the training and the equipment by which they can deal with this threat on their own, strikes me as a very reasonable policy.
Talbot?
I agree with this, actually. And though I'm very sympathetic to what Phyllis is saying, I'm afraid I'm looking at it from the perspective of somebody much more focused on Iraq than on the United States. What I am hearing directly from my relatives, my friends, my colleagues in universities there, and people who have just come out also, is that this is an exceptionally brutal, exceptionally extremist group. It's true that the Saudis behead, and in fact, at the bottom line is that the Saudis even have the same theological and political viewpoint as ISIS does. There's not really that much of a difference. But in terms of practice, one cannot get around the horrific humanitarian situation there. The destruction of the Yazidis and the Christian communities in areas that ISIS controls. In Raqqa right now, there are actually markets for women that have been captured to be sold as slaves. This is preposterous, you know. And just to emphasize, the Iraqi government does not want American forces on the ground. They're not asking for that. They're asking for logistical support, armaments, and aerial support. And I think, you know, again, to emphasize, there's a huge problem in the United States getting involved. There's a long track record going all the way back to the post-World War II period of United States involvement in the Middle East, often not having such positive results. But this is an unusual situation, and this is why I would hold my nose and say that, yes, the United States should be involved. And with all the problems I have with the way it's going about it, already the balance of forces is turning against ISIS. There's a couple of good things that have happened. I mean, the current Iraqi government is by no means such a massive improvement on the previous one, but because of the weakness, because of the threat that ISIS has posed, and because also, I must say, of American pressures, they have taken on some very progressive steps. There's much more of an atmosphere of inclusiveness. The two brigades that fought in the forefront at the Battle of Amerli, where ISIS was defeated, were composed primarily of people from Tikrit, you know, a bastion of Sunni Arab Iraq. There's a lot more efforts to actually involve Sunnis in the battle of ISIS, and it seems to be working with all kinds of grumbling and so on. I mean, I read the Iraqi press on a daily basis. Nothing is going very smoothly, but in general, I would agree with the policy that both the United States and the Iraqi government are pursuing right now.
I do want to get a call in here. We have maybe 8 or 9 minutes left in our segment, and I do want to get a call in. But Phyllis, I want you to have it respond, because there are three very different ideas here, and I think it's really interesting for our listeners to hear this. Phyllis, let me let you jump in very quickly, and then I'm going to go to our caller.
Well, you know, I think we heard it's horrifying, Tabit, to have family. I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it is for you sharing your political views and knowing, you know, that you have family and friends that are calling for intervention. But we saw the same thing in Libya 2 years ago. And many people in Libya said, this is a mistake. Even if we're desperate right now, even if this solves the immediate moment, it's going to end up worse. And unfortunately, those people were right. And I'm afraid this is going to be right again. Also, there are huge numbers, not all Sunnis, obviously, but many Sunnis in Iraq who still feel that they are better off allying with ISIS, much as they may hate their extremism and their violence, allying with them to protect them from the ravages of this government. So far, the new government has yet to make any of the changes that are going to be required to give people the confidence that this government is something more than the biggest and most powerful Shia militia in the country, which is how it's been acting for at least the last 6 or 7 years. So for those people, having the U.S. come in on the side of that government and allied with the Kurds, increasing Kurdish power in places like Kirkuk, where the Kurds now have made the claim and it's not any longer being contested, this is not something that, across the board, Iraqis are welcoming.
Let me try to get a quick call in here, and then we'll come back to our guests with some closing thoughts at 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Steiner, when I look at the whole Islamic fundamentalism / political religious ideology, where human beings are secondary to that, those political and religious ideology, isn't the main focus should be on stopping the spread of that type of fundamentalism before it becomes a big and large enough threat to threaten the U.S. and its allies in that region? Thanks, Mr. Steiner. That's just my question. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. I think part of the problem, we can start here, with this, and we have 4 minutes left, so as we all close out our thoughts, Stephen, I mean, the number of our allies throughout the Arabian Peninsula are those same fundamentalists. So what are your thoughts, Stephen, as we close out?
I couldn't quite hear the question. Mark, could you rephrase it?
It was just that we're looking at a world here where the fundamentalists are, these are a danger to all of us. We have to address them. But I think that we talked about that earlier. I just want to get some closing thoughts from the three of you on where we are.
Okay. And again, in terms of closing thoughts, I mean, as so much in the Middle East, I mean, there are no good options. Yes, of course, we need to employ diplomacy. We have to do what we can, by we, I mean the United States, to have a more inclusive Iraqi government that treats the Sunnis in a fair way. We have to try and deal with all the fundamental inequities and problems that exist in the Middle East. But right now, you've got these group of murderous thugs that are killing, raping, destroying communities under their control, millions of people. The United States has to do what it can without putting large numbers of boots on the ground to help the people in the area who are most threatened to deal with this threat, to turn a blind eye to this and simply feel that using economic and diplomatic means will somehow end the killings, I think are silly.
So
we have to do what we can when we can, and I think we would be ashamed if we didn't.
Now, we only have a few minutes left here, so I want to make sure we have everybody have a chance to say a closing thought. Fill us in, then we'll close out with Talbot.
Just quickly, I think that we have to do something, but that we have to do something that's going to work. Military forces, military strikes are not going to work. A year ago, we were hearing calls for using military force against a dictatorship in Syria that was worse than anyone else, that had used chemical weapons against its own people, that had dropped barrel bombs. We have to use weapons right now because it's desperate. All of a sudden, a year later, we're talking about going up against the strongest opposition to that dictatorship. Will a year from now, will we be hearing demands for going to war against somebody who's anti-ISIS because they're even more extreme, they're even more whatever? This isn't working. Every time we hear that, well, we need to do democracy and we need to do diplomacy, we need to do all these other things, but right now it's urgent, right now it's different, right now it's exceptional, so we have to use the military. We only use the military, and every time we do, the military is what makes the other solutions impossible.
Talbot Abdullah.
It's an extremely difficult situation. I still stand by what I said, that the options are very, very limited. In my opinion, the main deciding element here will be in Iraq, will be Iraqis, will be us, including those of us abroad. Whether the United States intervenes or not, I think the final solution will be how well the Iraqi elites, the Iraqi elements that have power, are able to compromise and create a real government of national unity. I don't think that American support, the way it's being requested, will scupper that. I think at the moment, because of the incredible danger that the country faces, it might actually assist it. But I agree that the main deciding force will be the Iraqis themselves.
Dr. Talbot Abdullah, always a pleasure to have you with us. Dr. Stephen David Phillips-Bennis will also be putting all their books and really interesting works that they've been writing on our websites. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you all. Thank you very much. Thank you all for joining us here today on The Mark Steiner Show. It's a pleasure to have you all being part of this conversation. Reminding you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeCube, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeCube, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeCube invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Henry. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern is Sianna Greaves. To the show again, podcast our past shows, visit us on the web. Please go to steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And right now, going out, we have Bittersweet Symphony, written by The Verve. Today, the birthday of their lead singer, Richard Ashcroft. And for Public Radio, it'll be EAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.